Hello, and welcome to the Mystagogy Podcast, hosted by the Adult Faith Programs at St. Stephen Martyr Church in Chesapeake, Virginia. In Greek, the word mystagogy means leading through the mysteries. In the earliest centuries of Christianity, mystagogy referred to the practice of helping Christians to appreciate more deeply the Christian mysteries into which they had been initiated by baptism, confirmation, and reception of the Eucharist. This present program of mystagogy is being developed and taught by Barbara Nicolosi Harrington, a university professor of screenwriting, cinema, great books, and theology. In this first presentation on Dante's Purgatorio, Barbara describes late repentant souls and the antechamber of purgatory, covering cantos 1 through 7.
So welcome to purgatory. We made it. Yeah. I have to say, I was so relieved to get out of hell. It was just a real oppressive thing. So, purgatory. Start really, as I always do, with a definition. Purge. Purge. The purgatory comes from the word to purge. And basically, it's the meaning we're looking at is there's purge in a political sense, like to free from something unwanted, meaning people. But purge, to free from something unwanted. And then to purify. The idea of purgatory is very much that, right? That, and for Dante, it's like, okay, everybody who's in purgatory is going to heaven. It's the antechamber to heaven. But because they've disfigured themselves by their sins, their ability to enjoy God will be lessened unless we can work out some of those kinks. And that's what purgatory is for, so that the soul can enjoy God more fully. And that's so we're going to have this like formation process for the souls. And we're going to talk about how it works. It's just beautiful. But what I thought I would do here is remember with Inferno, I gave you a few kind of notes to remember just by way of helping process the Inferno. I have some for Purgatorio. Okay. So first and foremost, in order to understand the Purgatorio, you have to understand that Dante's thesis is that the process of dying doesn't change the soul. That when the body falls away, the soul is the same. And simply the act of dying doesn't change us. Now, our Protestant brothers and sisters, I think they believe that act of dying actually does completely smooth out all the wrinkles and that the soul is blitzkrieged into perfection by the act of dying. That's not what Dante thinks. He thinks that dying is just dying. It's just a stage of life and the body is just falling away. So keep that in mind, that as you live, so when you die, that's who you are. And we're going to see that with the souls. Number two, I love this. I just can't believe he put this together. Healing from sin is a communal process. We talk about the church militant, which we are. So the Purgatorio is about the church suffering. And the first thing that has to happen in order to get healed from the formation process, to get healed from the wounds and the effects of your sins, the first thing you have to learn is to be a team player, to actually enter into the church. And what we're going to do is meet a whole bunch of souls who were outside the church, and then they do find their way to salvation, and then they're, ew, really? You? Like, I do it on my own. And that rugged individualism has no place in purgatory. This beautiful idea of we're going to see the church suffering, that there's this antechamber to purgatory before you even get into purgatory. So purgatory is the antechamber to heaven. Purgatory has its own antechamber where people have to learn to be part of the church. And the way that's done, I love this music in the background because that's the whole purgatory. There's hymns going on in the background. So you would think I planned this. I might have them do it next week. But there are basically two things that you're going to see all throughout the purgatorio. And one is rituals, that there are going to be rituals the way we have the ritual of baptism. And we're going to see Dante, when he first arrives in purgatory, the guard of purgatory says, okay, he's got to get this, do this to him and that to him, and then he can start. And so there are certain rituals all the way through. And then secondly, there's music. They're singing. And all through the, especially at night, because in purgatory, everything stops at night. Everyone has to rest from the work of what God is doing in them, which is a lovely kind of thing if you think about it, right? It's like, okay, you've spent all day crying, carrying rocks around on your shoulders. Now you can sleep and we'll start again tomorrow morning. But in purgatory, for Dante, at night, there's rest. And so before they rest, they sing the Salve Regina. They sing the Te Deum. And these, that everyone has to learn the hymns. And then they sing them together. This is for the people who are mad at me for starting singing at the morning mass. I'm right. No, it's funny because not only do I like singing, but I really think we need a transition from private prayer, just me talking to Jesus here, to, oh, now we're doing this together. And so that's what Pope Benedict says. That's what the opening hymn achieves. It says, oh, now we're all doing this together. And so anyway, sometimes I call out the hymn and then I sing a different version of it than everyone else. I had to say it before you did. All right, good. Okay, so anyway, so watch for that. Watch for the rituals. And we can talk about ritual and why our religion needs rituals. Why we need rituals in the practice of our faith. What does ritual do? Actually, let me throw that out there right now. What does ritual do? Say again? It orders. What do you mean? It's consistency. Okay, very good, huh? Habits. Yeah. You know who you are by the habits, right? And I'm thinking of when I was a child and it was like, oh, rituals in our family. So we have one coming up, my birthday coming up next week. And so our family ritual is you get to pick the meal, right? You are queen for the day. You get to pick the meal and whatever it is, the family will rally around that, right? And that's part of our little ritual, right? Of a way of food is love for Sicilians. So there it is, right? But I think that when you think about the church having rituals, it situates us in the family, doesn't it? It's, oh, I know how to do this. We all do this together, and that makes me part of this group. And the ritual also, it brings the material world and the spiritual world together. So we're going to do something tangible that's going to be an exterior sign of an invisible reality. And so anyway, we're going to see part of being healed in purgatory is doing these rituals, submitting to them, okay? The antechamber is for those who need to learn how to do church first. I found this thing. They say, I don't play well with others. The others can suck it, right? So if that's your attitude, then you're going to be in the antechamber of purgatory learning. You actually need these people. You need them. They're your brothers and sisters, and we're going to do this together. And one of the things you're going to see in the various rooms of levels of purgatory where the souls are, they're assigned their cures, and the cures sometimes are very hard, but they're leaning on each other. They're helping each other and they're pulling each other up and everything. And that's how it's supposed to be. Okay, number four, it is possible to suffer enjoy. And so purgatory, even though it is a place of suffering, longing, the suffering that comes from longing, and also the suffering of having your kinks worked out, it is also a place of tremendous joy, and it pervades the work. We made it. And so the three things it seems that Dante is saying, you can survive suffering, number one, if you know what the purpose of it is. If you know it has a purpose, I can get through this. Number two, if you know it's not forever, it's, oh, okay, this has an end date. And so I can just keep that in mind. I'm not going to be here forever. And then number three, you can suffer with joy if you know it's the better of the other of two options. The other option is hell. You know what? I'm really happy to be here suffering. And so that's, so what we're going to start seeing, right? Hopefully you start seeing now. This book is really about our life now. And that's, this antechamber we're going to talk about tonight is us deciding to take on the spiritual life, to start growing in the spiritual life. And which is what we've been talking about all last year, right? Father Benedict, Teresa of Avila, St. Augustine, everyone's kind of hitting, you've got to start out. We actually have to make a decision. I took this from Viktor Frankl's, one of my favorite little books is called Man's Search for Meaning. He was one of the premier initial psychiatrists when psychiatry was just developing in the late 20s. And he ended up getting into Auschwitz because he was a Jew. And when he's in Auschwitz, he says, okay, I'm going to turn this into a research opportunity. And as a psychiatrist, I'm going to observe human behavior in these conditions. And he comes away believing in the freedom of the soul, that man is an immortal free being because of what he sees. But basically, he has many things to say about suffering and how different people handle it. But one of the things he says is despair is suffering without meaning. So the idea is always, what is the meaning here? What could possibly be the meaning that would make this suffering now not something for despair, but actually something to be glad about? Okay. Excuse me again? The first one and two are like childhood. That's cool. Childbirth. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Huh? How about that? Yeah. Exactly. Look what you're going to have. And the Bible says that, right? That when the mother's going through labor, she's wailing, but in the morning, she's rejoicing. Very good. Yeah, there's absolutely parallels in the Purgatorio to rebirth. In fact, the first ritual is a kind of baptism. And it's, okay, you've been now born into eternal life, and here's the ceremony. Okay, number five. Anything that you, earthly fame, family, power, all of that stops before you get on the boat to purgatory. We're going to meet Frederick II, who is the great emperor, Frederick II, I think a Holy Roman emperor. He's in hell with the heretics. If we remember, he was one of the guys that stood up in the graves burning. His son, Manfred, is in purgatory, and we're going to meet him. And Manfred was just as bad as his father, but he had a last minute good thought. And so he's here. Their mother is in heaven. Frederick's mother is in heaven. Manfred's grandmother. So the same family has people in all three levels. There are levels in heaven and there are levels in purgatory. Now, both the levels in purgatory and heaven are transitory. That is, you keep moving up until you get to the mystical rose, your seat at the final thing. Yes. But as my mother expressed this quite a lot, as there's no U-Haul behind the hearse. She used to say this to us all the time. I found out that somebody said it to me. Billy Graham said that first. I was like, my mother said it first to me. And she said it a lot. But the idea of there's no U-Haul behind the hearse is you don't take anything with you. Accept the qualities of your soul. And so these people who go into the afterlife, and we saw them in hell, what family are you from? And who I beat your town in two wars. And they're boasting and bragging still about their earthly achievements. And in purgatory, there's going to be a little bit of the impulse to do it in the antechamber, but then it's going to fall away. And everyone's going to realize, oh, please, none of that matters here anymore. So I think one of the things Dante's trying to do is challenge us to start thinking like that now. Stop seeing ourselves in light of these weird earthly ways of evaluating human success. The fifth note, the spiritual life is three things in the Purgatorio. It's dynamic, that is, it's moving. You're either moving ahead or you're slipping back. And we're going to hear one of the souls says that at night. Sometimes some of them go back down. They're wandering around and they go back down. And he says, but in the, eventually everybody realizes that we're supposed to be climbing. But you're going to see the climb is hard in some places. And some people are looking for another way, even in purgatory. But it's dynamic. It's task-oriented. Every level, you have to do something. Yeah. You have to achieve something. And then finally, it's ordered. Now, the order essentially is, and so one of the first things that's going to happen when Dante gets there is an angel is going to carve on his forehead seven P's. And that's one of the rituals when he first gets there. And this, the P's stand for in Italian, anybody know? Peccata, sin, ashamed, right? The seven sins. So he's then going to go up the mountain. When he finally gets into purgatory, then there's the seven deadly sins. And they're funny because they're opposite of the way it was in hell. The biggest circle at the bottom is pride. The smallest at the top is lust. And that's the last one you got to clear out before you get into the earthly paradise, to get back to the Garden of Eden at the end and then heaven. But it's this ritual of we're going to go through this and we're going to do it in an orderly way. And Dante's saying a couple of things. He's saying one of the things that sin has brought into all of our lives is chaos. That sin makes us chaotic, disordered, out of whack, out of proportion, incontinent, all of that. And so when we start to come close to God, we have to introduce some order. We have to start thinking, acting rationally, making choices, and then moving through real steps, if you will. Yeah, so Dante, every time he conquers a level, somebody goes and races a pee. And there it is. Huh? But you've got to work your steps, Dante. You can't skip. Okay. Okay. All right. So let's start now. Those are the notes, huh? I'm just going to say a word about the geography of purgatory. As we noticed in hell, that the sinners basically make their own geography by their sins. Like they create the environment of their sin. Lust is the whirlwind. The greedy people, it's collecting rocks. The people who were sullen are in a swamp full of filth, and they're getting angrier and angrier, whatever. Purgatory has a similar situation where some of the geography is really been planned by God to heal. It's like obstacle courses or whatever you're going to have to, we figured out a way to design this terrace And that's going to fix you, proud people. And so every one of the levels has things that God's allowed to be put there that are going to go towards curing the sin, healing the effects of it. And but what we're meant to do reading it is to say, huh, what would that look like in my life today? How can I try that out and see if it helps me heal that problem? And it's fun to think that way. But what basically purgatory is, it's a place on earth. Purgatory is a place on earth. And I think that Dante does that deliberately because he wants you to be thinking of this getting over these sin stuff now. But there's an island out there somewhere past the Strait of Gibraltar in the Atlantic Ocean. And right on the island, there's this one mountain. And the whole bottom of the mountain is like rocks and crevices and everything. And this is where a lot of the souls get dropped off. The boat takes them there from, they die and they come over on the boat and they get off the boat and they wander around until they're ready to go through the gate, which is here. And then it starts this very ordered progress through the seven deadly sins. This is the seven-story mountain. So there was a book by Thomas Merton that he named the seven-story mountain after Dante, because he said, the first part of my life was hell. Then I became a Christian and it was purgatory while I got my act together. And then I became a Cistercian and it was heaven. Had an interesting heaven ending. But anyway, it's a beautiful book and very powerful. But he got that from Dante. Okay. So here's the graph, basically. And you can't really see it from where you're sitting. But what we're going to see is the people who are in, the sinners who are stuck in the anti-purgatory, they're not stuck, but they have to be there for 30 times as long of the days as they stayed away from the church or God. So we're going to meet people who are like, I was 47 years I was outside the church. And so it's like, okay, 30 times that is how many years you're going to be in purgatory. I know, right? I always remember that like horrible story when I was doing the Fatima movie and in my research. So the story of Fatima, this one's, you need adult beverages for this one. But there was a girl in the village, I think she was 17. And Lucia, when she was 12, really admired this girl. She was a really good dancer. So we're talking Algestrel, Portugal, in the mountains, right? And she had just died 5 months before. And when the children see Mary for the first time, Mary says, where are you from? She says, I'm from heaven. And Lucia immediately says, oh, do you know my friend Amelia? Whatever. And Mary gets very grim and says, brace yourself. She'll be in purgatory until the end of the world. I know, right? And you're kind of I give up right now. But no, anyway. But they took their time. We'll look at the antechamber in a second, but they basically made God wait, and now they have to wait. And that's their own fault. Like it's not that God is making them wait. They are making themselves wait, which, by the way, is a thinking of the church on indulgences. This is too funny. Because you keep thinking about it when you're reading this, because the people keep asking, the souls in purgatory keep asking Dante, go back and have my family say prayers for me. Go back and have my family buy masses for me. And pretty much everybody, that's what they want to say. But indulgences in the church, it isn't that the church is canceling your time in purgatory. The church is saying, if you do this thing, your time in purgatory will be lessened because it's going to have an effect in your life and in your soul. One of them is if you spend 20 minutes reading the scriptures, every time you spend 20 minutes reading the scriptures, it's like 300 days out of purgatory. Why? Because reading the scriptures in a focused way for 20 minutes has that power to change you. So when the church actually, she doesn't, when it's, I suppose, in an evil form, or in a kind of weird form they got into in the Middle Ages, it could be problematic. But the way the church sees it now is we're just assigning to give you an idea how helpful certain spiritual practices are. Yes. And if you do them, then you will find yourself now less likely to be in purgatory. There's also the treasury of saints and the, everybody, there's extra stuff hanging in there. But I like that way of thinking about it. Anyway, okay, so you have basically, in the same way that in hell, we had the three kinds of sin. Remember the three beasts, the leopard, carnal sins, incontinent sins, the lion, sins of anger and wrath, and then the she-wolf, fraud and malice. Purgatory has three levels too. Once you get there, once you get out of the antechamber, you're going to find that the bottom level is love that has been perverted. These are people who they were loving, it's just in a perverse way. So the envious, the wrathful, and the proud are all perverse. You say the proud, how is pride a perverse kind of loving? Anybody off the top of your head? Very good. I'm loving myself all out of proportion. Then there's love that's defect, that's love defected. So it's like you do love, but you have, your love has some defects in it, and that's the slothful. The whole level is just lazy people, that their love was insufficient because they just can't rally themselves. And then the last level is love excessive. These are people who they loved. So the avaricious, the gluttonous, and then the lustful. So we're going, but I just love how it's flipped from hell. Okay. Now, when he first comes out of hell, they first come out of hell and they stagger up. They've just climbed up Satan's, or down, they realize down Satan's fur, and they come out on the shores of this island and they look, and he says, and there were four stars in the heavens that no one had seen since Adam and Eve. And these four stars stand for the four cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, fortitude, and moderation. And I'm like, wait a minute. The world had these, but Dante's saying not in their purity and fullness because of sin. That even a good, virtuous pagan couldn't really live justice in its purity. So these human level virtues, the stars now are up. He's getting a look at them for the first time. What's going to happen is they're going to fade, those stars. And then the next night, it's going to be three more stars. And this is faith, hope, and charity. They're going to be it's going to light the way between these two things. Okay. So let's talk about this antechamber of purgatory, which I've nicknamed failure to launch. So what we're going to find here is there's four kinds of people that are stuck wandering around the base of purgatory, not yet climbing that mountain. And here's the four kinds. And by the way, the parallel is there are four kinds of people who are not seriously engaged in trying to get to know God, getting into closer intimacy with God in this life. And it's the same four reasons. So number one, they are nostalgic for the life of the body. We're going to see these people right away. That's a funny little episode in the thing, but they're kind of like, yes, they're dead, but wow, no more lasagna? Really? If you tell me there's lasagna there, I could do it. or whatever, right? Whatever it is, that thing. I have a friend and she's, I'm a runner. I have to run every day. I wouldn't know who I am. And I was like, when you hit 70, you're going to figure to get through that one really fast. But she says, I can't even imagine not running every day. So you just, you know what? Everything we can't imagine life without is going to go. So you might as well start working on it now, not to say stop running, but get things in proportion, right? The life of the body has many good things. In C.S. Lewis's The Weight of Glory, which is his analogy of the last things, or specifically purgatory, people are all on a bus. And the bus is riding around and all the dead souls are on the bus. And then the bus stops at the foot of the Mount of Heaven. And the souls from heaven come down. They take turns and shifts to come out of heaven and stand there at the bus stop and plead with the souls on the bus to get off. And the souls on the bus are like, I can't. I'm hearing you, but my son needs me. My son, Jeffrey, I can't leave Jeffrey. So you have the souls on the bus and they're still looking back at their life on earth. And Lewis says at a certain point, they get finally free of the life on earth and then they go surging forward towards God. As Lewis says, at the moment of death, God will stand in front of us as he is. And you will look at him and go, at last, you, this is what I've been searching for my whole life. And you will surge towards him. Or he will stand in front of you and you'll go, is there anybody else back there? Turn around and run away. That's hell. Or you will stand there going, okay, talk to me a little bit. Let me hear. Make your case. Right. And that purgatory in C.S. Lewis is that frozen state where someone just can't let go. They can't surge towards God and they don't want to run away and they're frozen. I think Lewis stole that from Dante. And so nostalgic for the life of the body. Number two, we're going to meet right away. This is funny. There, one of the boats arrives at the shore of purgatory. All the dead get off and they go up to Dante and they're like, tell us where to go. And Dante's like, I don't know where to go. And so they're just confused and they're milling around and they don't know. A lot of people do not set out on the spiritual journey. They don't figure out how to pray better, how to be in intimacy with God, how to read the scriptures, how to take advantage of the sacraments. They don't know how to do any of it. And so they're just clueless, frozen. I was talking to somebody last week and I was talking about how much I love confession and everything. And she goes, when you talk about confession, it's nothing like what I do. And she said, I'm essentially doing confession the way I learned. And I said, I hope you learned when you were 20. She goes, I learned when I was 7. I was like, you're doing confession the way you learned when you were 7? See, but who? No one told her you should grow up a little bit. That idea for Dante and that these people just, they're completely clueless about how to begin. Okay. Number three, they're lazy. They're lazy. There's all kinds of reasons for being lazy in that we're going to see, we're going to meet. There's, I think, three cantos on the indolent. And people are indolent for a bunch of reasons. One reason they're indolent is because they have no confidence. In other words, what's the point? If I get up there, then I'm going to not get in anyway. They don't like redheads. I'm sure. Whatever. But they literally have talked themselves out of having any energy. And that's one reason that he puts them in the indolent. But there's a bunch of reasons why people do not have energy spiritually. Finally, they're caught up in earthly politics and intrigue. So this is different than the nostalgia for the life of the body. The nostalgia for the life of the body is the beautiful things sensually. This is people who are like, we have got to keep fighting this war to conquer whatever, right? whatever your cause is, I can't die. I am the head of the pro-life movement. I can't die. I'm championing whatever. But that we're going to see a whole bunch of people whose politics has become their meaning. And they're not bad-willed people, but it's become too much. And when they get to purgatory, their cause, they still have their causes, but God's, there's no racism up here anymore. Just so you know, let it go. You gonna say something? Yeah. No. Yeah. Hello. I'm here now. Those problems of the earth that you were defining yourself by fighting that thing, it doesn't exist up here anymore. Okay. All right. So the first person we meet on the beach is Cato. Now, if I had said to you, here's a quiz after doing the Inferno. People who have died who were virtuous, but before Christ, where do they go? In limbo, right? That stage of contentment. That's the first like level of upper hell there. Wrong. Cato was a Roman Stoic. He was the father of Roman Stoicism, a pagan who died before Christ hundreds of years. Where do these people who commit suicide go in the Inferno? What did anybody remember what happens to them? They throw away their human life, so they get life of trees. They become plants. That's where you go if you commit suicide. Wrong. Cato committed suicide. Yeah, huh? Now he is appointed the guard of all purgatory. Okay, what is Dante doing here? I don't think he's being inconsistent. I think he's saying, there's a whole other perspective now that's going to happen. You're going to get your perspective broadened as we move through purgatory and then heaven. You're going to start to see things the way God sees them, and they're going to be much more complicated. Now, Cato technically, even though he killed himself, he was opposed to Julius Caesar, who was turning the Roman Republic into an empire. This was the destruction of this beautiful thing. And Cato had no way to get the attention of the masses who knew he was a noble man. And he couldn't just look like I'm going along with this. And so he chose as a statement to end his life rather than to be part of the new empire, which was the destruction of the Roman Republic. So it wasn't a suicide that was a rejection of his own life. It was an act of trying to get everyone's attention. So now you're like, oh, huh, all suicides are not created equal. And then he's put in charge of purgatory. Why? The word that Cicero used to describe Cato was that he was the most disciplined human being you have ever met. He was a Stoic of Stoics. Why? What does Dante saying to us by putting such a one in charge of the spiritual formation program that is purgatory? What do you think? Excuse me? He's not going to be swayed, and this is serious business. This is task discipline oriented, no excuses. And we're going to see that right away. It's really funny what's going to happen, huh? Really interesting. Right off the bat, someone that we thought we learned is in hell, we find out is not. Oh, yeah. So this is the artwork from Dore. Huh? They meet him and he's very stern, but he's like, we don't have live people here. That is against the rules. And Virgil's like, I know, Cato, take a breath. But he's here because of God, whatever. And so Cato's like, okay, but he still needs to do the ritual. Take him in the back, down the hill. And basically he gives him two commands. He's like, he has the stench of hell all over him. Wash him up. And number two, you got to put the reed around his waist. Find a reed and put it around his waist. So Virgil takes them. They go down by the water. They find a big reed. They first wash him all up. And he says, it's fun part of the thing. He's like, and I was like, the soot of hell like got off of me. And I was like, I can breathe again, which is a lovely metaphor for when you stop sinning. But then the reed thing, right? So he says, bind a smooth green reed about his waist and clean his face of all trace of the pit. The reed. So I think this is referring to a couple things in scripture. Like, why is he tying a reed around his waist? First of all, this is the little baptism ritual, right? In the same way we wash the baby, we pour water on him, and then we give them a new garment. So he's getting a new garment, which is a reed. And this is going to, he's going to wear it all the way through purgatory around his waist. You have this beautiful phrase from Isaiah that when the Messiah comes, the bruised reed he shall not break. So the bruised reed refers to the weak believer. That's the people in purgatory. They're weak in their faith. They're weak in their, because of their sins. But Jesus will not break them. And the reed is a symbol of that promise. But number two, the reed reminds us this story from scripture that when Jesus was mocked, the soldiers went and found a reed and put it in his hand and struck him with it. So the reed is also a tangible, like, armor of Jesus's passion. Jesus died for me. I'm putting this around my waist, a sign of what he suffered. Nothing can hurt me anymore. So that's our first little ritual that Dante, the pilgrim, has to go through. Okay, so now they come up from getting the reed and getting all clean, and they hit the beach again. And just then a boat lands with new souls who are newly dead. And lo and behold, his old buddy, Casella, is there. This is when all the souls come running at Dante. Actually, here, they run towards Dante because they're like, oh, a body. We know what that is. So they all start snuggling up to Dante, all the newly dead. Why? Because bodies, they know. It's familiar, and they feel safe being around him. And he's like, get away from me, you creepy dead people. But they're all like, they're afraid. And they're drawn to him. But anyway, Casella steps out and says, Dante, my old buddy. Dante's like, Casella, remember the great songs we used to sing? You had the best voice. And Casella's like, yes. And Dante's like, let's hear one for old time's sake. And so Casella starts singing, and everybody in the beach is, all right, including Virgil, and they're all rocking out. And all of a sudden, Cato comes around the corner. He's like, excuse me, you're dead. And he drives them all away, and they all go scurrying, afraid. Okay, so what was this, huh? This was the people who are still stuck on the old times. They're looking backwards. And so Cato has to teach them, no, you have to look up the mountain now. You have to look towards God. And the good old days are gone. And they weren't the good old days anyway. Let's be real. So here he is coming at them and saying, break it up. Okay. So Dante and Virgil start wandering through the woods around the base of the mountain. And all of a sudden, they pass this guy who comes out and says, "I recognize your accent." And they're like, "Oh, and his name is Manfred." And Manfred's with a group of souls. And pretty much everybody we're going to meet is with a group of souls. They all cluster together, which is part of the church thing, right? But these are the contumacious. So contumacious means stubbornly and willfully disobedient. So these are people who were stubbornly opposed to God during their life. They listened and they rejected his law. They rejected everything until the last minute. And so Manfred says, "You met my father. Have you met my father? His father is Frederick II. Right? And so he's, "Oh, I was just like him. I was a bloody man of war. And I was like, we're going to do what we want, power for our family." He said, "But then I got wounded mortally on the battlefield. And as the blood is draining out of me, I had a flicker of, I could have done it another way. And that's why I'm here." That God scooped up that moment and took it as, "Okay, you've repented." So then he says, "I beg you, when you return there over the horizon, go to my sweet daughter. By good prayers in our behalf, my time may be reduced." So first soul who asks us to pray, and many of them do. And especially they ask for masses. The first couple times I read Dante, it totally changed me about getting masses for, I always do it for people now, like religiously, because imagine them on the receiving end of that. But okay. The next group they're going to meet, they keep wandering on. So the tumacious, they're all sitting there stubbornly trying to decide if they're dead. And it's not that they're sinning anymore. They can still be tempted in that level because there's still a little bit of self-will going on. And they're adapting. And God wants them to come running towards him. He's not going to force them even at this point. But he's going to be patient and wait. And hopefully, eventually, they'll get sick of sitting on a beach. Now, the next group, though, they go a little further. And he says, "There we found, stretched in the shade, some people on the ground. And there's a guy named Belacqua." And Belacqua, but basically Dante says to Virgil, "Why are these people laying on the ground here? Why aren't they climbing the mountain?" And all of a sudden, one of the souls says, "You climb it if you're such a flash." And then he laughs lightly, and you realize it's not like the hellish voice, but it's this guy. And so then Dante recognizes him, Belacqua, as a man who made musical instruments in his life in Italy, but he was so lazy that people would be like, "He makes the best musical instruments, but it takes him like 10 times longer than everybody else." And so Dante puts him in purgatory with the indolent and the lazy, and they're all sitting around. And Dante says, "Why don't you climb the mountain and get out of these woods?" And he says, "Oh, if I did, I'd probably get up there and God would tell me to wait anyway." And then he says, "If God wants me up there, I'm sure he can get me up there." Ooh, that voice like totally knocked me over. It's funny. I remember when I was a nun and we were all like, "Which of the seven deadly sins is your biggest issue?" And I said, "Yeah, sloth." And one of the other sisters was like, "Sloth is not that bad." And I was just like, "Ooh, you have no idea. You have no idea." But my mother said to me once when I was a little girl, "Barbara, if you ever put as much time into your schoolwork as you put into finding a way to not do your schoolwork, you would be unstoppable." But my sloth was something that I fed very laboriously. Anyway, this is an interesting concept that some people are lazy, that they don't have the urgency to act, because they don't believe in themselves enough. I'm nobody. I'm a speck in the scheme of things. If God wants me to be somewhere, he's going to make it happen. And you say, it sounds like resignation to the will of God, but Dante says it's actually laziness. And as I said, there's three different cantos where we hear all these people give their reasons for being indolent. I'm really not sure of what to do. Find a reason, then learn, figure it out. But how long can you sit there and say, I can't move because I really don't know what to do, so I'm just going to stay here? Like, eventually, you got to learn, right? I've had students do that to me all the time. I didn't turn in my assignment because I couldn't figure out how to make the computer thing work. And it's like, learn. That's the answer. All the other students have figured it out. Learn. So that's the other one, indolence. I think that there are some people that we meet that are indolent because they were unfocused. So they divert. They start running here, and then they start running there, and then they start running here. And that this stopping and starting ends up making them not really get going. So that's why the ordered thing of purgatory, you have to pick a direction and stay at it. And this is how I've set my face, and I'm going to see this through. And anyway, very interesting to read that whole section of why all these people who are not, they're going to heaven. They're just taking 500 years to get there. And they don't have to. But there's all these reasons they have for not moving. Okay. So the next group we meet after the indolent is, and is still, these are still people in the antechamber. People who died violent deaths without the last rites. So these are the people who thought they had so much more time. You ever meet anybody like that? Somebody who's dabbling in darkness, thinking, you know what, eventually I'm going to get my act together. And then they get hit by a truck. Like they ran out of time. And these are the people that we meet here. They've been playing the world's game, telling themselves, eventually I'm going to get my act together. I'm going to turn back to God. I'm going to do the right thing. But right now, I have to do this thing. And they get saved at the end because they do have the intention. But they're pathetic. And their stories, one after the other, are very sad. Now, one of the first ones we meet is Boncontre of Montefalto, who's the son of Guido. Now, remember Guido, maybe, in hell. Guido was the guy who was the evil counselor, lower level of hell, who in the end says, yeah, I've been a rat and a rogue my whole life. Now I'm going to become a Franciscan, and God's going to have to let me go to heaven. Right? He plays that game. And then at the end, St. Francis comes to get him, and then the devil shows up and says, this one's mine. He was fooling. This is his son now in purgatory. And he says, I live the same life as my father. And I die too, a man in a violent way. But while I was dying, said, all of a sudden, there was a final moan which came out of me, which was the name of Mary. And then speech went out from me and I fell. And that's the difference. So you see one after the other, one of the things that's cool about the Purgatorio is how neatly it matches up to the Inferno. We meet people in the Purgatorio who are almost mirror images of the people we met in hell, only now they have repentance. And the next one we meet, who's one of the coolest for me, is Pia de Ptolemy. Pia comes up to them, and she's on the other side of the water, And she says, I'm hearing you. She goes, go back and say to my friends and family that you saw me and that I'm here. She says, I was an adulterous woman and I was murdered by my husband when he caught us in adultery. And then she fades away. Who does that remind you of story-wise from hell? Francesca. Remember Francesca of the two-page like memory of her sin? So what with Francesca is she's still reliving the sin. She's still enjoying it. She's still, it's so glamorous. And then she's got so much hatred in her towards her husband and all of this stuff. And she's still caught up in the whirlwind of the sin. Pia, who had the exact same sin and died the exact same way, instead is now have two sentences. Very simply, just go tell the people who knew me, who love me, that I'm okay. I'm here. No bragging about the sin, no reliving, nothing. Really quite beautiful. Okay. The next group we meet hanging around the antechamber is all of these people who were involved in politics. And interestingly, we meet them, and there's also poets hanging around with the politicians. Dante is a poet and a politician, and these two make use of each other in the world. The politicians find poets to sing a good song for them, right, to make their case. And so you see this group of people. So some of them were involved in good causes, and some of them were involved in bad causes, but all of them were involved in causes. And that politics had become their raison d'etre, the main thing they think about. Now, I grew up the year after the baby boom ended. I grew up a Gen Xer, which means where there's in between all the real generations, there's 10 years with things that don't have a name. You just watch the power go over your head to the next. So that was me. I'm in that lost generation between the boomers and Gen X. Gen X, yeah. And, but I grew up, you know, in the shadow of the boomers for whom everything was politics. Everything. And it's just disgusted. So it's funny because the boomer generation mantra, think of some of the mantras of the boom. Don't trust the man, question authority, look out for number one, make love, not war, right? My generation, when they queried, what is your generation's mantra? We came up with the word whatever. Because we're so like over politics because we'd been saturated by it. But anyway, it just shows back in the 13th century, this is also going on. There's something about human beings that we get into the political thing and it becomes our whole focus. He has some things to say about all of that, but one of the things he throws out there is a line from Aristotle's Ethics, which is he's reworking something that's in Plato's Republic. But Aristotle asserts that you can't keep changing laws, because when you keep changing laws, the people will lose respect for the law. So that it is therefore better, Aristotle says, it's better to tolerate small injustices than change the law. Because in the end, it's going to be the people's hearts if they adopt the virtue themselves, and then they don't need the law. The law is basically for people who don't have any inner moral compass. But think about that. It's better to tolerate a small injustice than change the law, because the effect is that people lose the effect of law. Dante says, one of the problems with you people is you keep thinking you come to power and you're going to change all the laws. And then there's this massive flip. And all of your preferences and your friends and your little persnickety things become the law of the land. And then the next people come in and they reverse it all and they put theirs in. And so the people learn the lesson that it's not about goodness, it's about power, the way we live together. And so he has that throwaway. It's like, you said you had a righteous cause, but really your cause was your own will. And he says, the main problem, and then there's this beautiful section about Italy. What is wrong with Italy? It's like a whole canto of the factions and the divisions. We have this beautiful country, and yet we're at each other's throats. Siena against Florence, against Lucia, against Norcia, against Rome, against the Pope, and that they're all of them fighting each other all the time. The Guelphs, the Black Guelphs, and the White Guelphs, and the Ghibellines. And he's like, it's the factions that is the problem. So what's really cool in purgatory is people are in groups, but they're not factions. And one of the things Dante wants you to ask is, what's the difference? What's the difference between a church community like this one and a faction in local Chesapeake politics, which we could become? But what's the difference? It seems fundamentally we're all standing around Jesus, that he has called us together. We all love him, so we put up with each other. And then he works through us together. That a faction, on the other hand, is some person, some charismatic person getting the center, and everybody working around that person until they fall and somebody else takes it over. Anyway, interesting that these people are on the way to heaven, but they're going to take hundreds of years to get over the fact that all their influence is gone. And in fact, there's one part at the end of this canto where the poet stands there and says, that's the king of there, blah, blah, and that's the secretary of state. And over there is the head judge of the Supreme Court. And over there, he's this huge list of all these famous rulers. And they're all sitting here because they've lost their self-identity. And they're not too sure about climbing that mountain. Okay, so the last point that I want to make is about this humble poet, Sordello, Dante's showing the difference between hell and purgatory here. So you remember when Dante met the poets in hell, they were like, my poetry is better than yours. When we meet Sordello and he finds out it's Virgil, he's like, you are the greatest poet ever. You are the best poet. I am nothing compared to you. And it's this beautiful, humble scene in which Sordello is saying the truth, essentially, but without any bitterness, with only joy and gratitude that he gets to meet Virgil. And so, yes, you can have success and go to heaven, but the key is going to be humility and grace, as opposed to self-focus. Huh? Anyway, here he is groveling at Virgil's feet saying, you're the best poet ever. Okay, so that's pretty much the antechamber. After that, they start climbing the mountain. And it's a really, there was a slide that was out of place here that is the very last thing is them on the, here it is. Climbing the mountain, and he says, squeezed in between two walls that almost meet, we labor upward through the riven rock, a climb that calls for both our hands and feet. When a soul begins the lower slope, it must most labor, then less and less the more it nears its goal. So that's purgatory, is man up, Marine. Man up, Marine, huh? And yes.
Question.
Yes.
No one confused probably because it wasn't very beginning. So Dante, he was a poet, but was he very involved in the church?
Not so much in the church, but he was in politics and philosophy. But he was tangentially involved in the church because they were all Catholic. And he was very devout. But he ends up siding against Boniface VIII, who sees the papacy in terms of political power. And so Dante, much to his chagrin, gets excommunicated. and dies excommunicate with half the city of Florence too. Yeah. Cool. Yes. Oh, the four cardinal virtues. So yeah, justice. So prudence being the queen of the virtues, right? Prudence is wisdom in action. Yeah. Wisdom in action, according to Aristotle. Prudence is knowing what the right thing is to do and then choosing it. Then there's justice. Justice is giving to each his due. Giving to God his due, giving to your husband his due, giving to your friends their due, giving to your country its due, giving to your kids their due. So it gets complicated. But a just person gives to everyone their due. And then fortitude is courage to be able to act on what you know prudentially. And then finally, moderation is being able to manage yourself, regulating your own behaviors and living in a balance. The perfection of those we haven't seen since Adam and Eve, because sin has tainted even the human virtues. Okay? So thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Mystagogy Podcast. The music for the podcast is provided by George Serra. Learn more about his music in the show notes. Until next time, be well and God bless.